Now it's time for Power of Prophecy, continuing the legacy of Tex Mars, exposing evil, and promoting Jesus Christ as Savior. Here's your host, Jerry Barrett.
Hello, friends, and welcome to another edition of Power of Prophecy. I'm your host, Jerry Barrett. Honored to have you join me again this week. I have asked a dear friend of the ministry and mine. He is a contributing reporter for American Free Press. He's been on with Tex. He's been on with me. He spoke at one of our conferences. His name is Mark Anderson. Mark, welcome to Power of Prophecy.
It's great to be back, Jerry. A bit of a hiatus. I've done some shows in relatively recent times, but there was a bit of a break, and I'm chomping at the bit to get back into the fire here.
Oh, yeah. When I contacted you about coming on the show, you had a very intriguing title and just kind of a hint of what we were going to cover. It is JFK at 62. That number right there, Mark, still slays me that it has been 62 years since we experienced that coup d'etat in Dealey Plaza.
Indeed. It's not like a, you know, major marker like the 60th year, the 65th year. I was in Dallas for the 50th year in 2013, but every year the interest groups meet in and around Dallas, the JFK Historical Group, the JFK Lancer Group. There used to be the COPA group. I'm not sure they're as active since John Judge, their leader, died some years ago, but the groups remain active. But sadly, but not necessarily paradoxically, they're not going to be on the right track for reasons I'll explain based on experiences that I had, some of it completely unexpected, much of it completely unexpected. And I was very reluctant at first to get involved, but it was as if the Lord landed something in my lap that I really felt compelled to move forward to despite some initial misgivings. It's a different paradigm, and it shows the sheer power of deception that is afoot in our country. You'll see what I mean as we proceed.
You know, I read Michael Collins Piper's book, Final Judgment, outstanding work, but I still go back to the Warren Commission and all of the lies and deception that we were stuck with. And then it was, as I was growing up, it was taught as fact that a lone gunman, Lee Harvey Oswald, killed John F. Kennedy. He did it in broad daylight. And then, Jacob Rubenstein takes out Lee Harvey before he can, I guess, garner any sympathy or anything. But the narrative has been in our lexicon for 62 years, Mark.
Yeah, and there's still lamentations and complaints and sorrowful, frustrated kind of talk on Facebook and among the JFK interest groups that we still haven't, and here's the word, solved this thing, quote unquote. Let me go back to the year 2007, and I was in the greater Dallas area, and I was covering a conference that included G. Edward Griffin and some other people of interest for AFP. And a guy tapped me on the shoulder and gave me a book in shrink wrap called My God, I'm Hit. And it wasn't the author. It was some associate or reader of his. And the author, as I looked at it, was Brian David Anderson. And he's an Anderson, A-N-D-E-R-S-E-N. So he's an S-E-N, I'm an S-O-N, no blood relation. And the book was, to say the least, unorthodox. Some would say to the extreme. I read it with some bewilderment, and yet I think I've told you before, I grew up watching Columbo and reading and watching Sherlock Holmes serials and whatnot. And I've always had that, maybe not a good one, but I've always had that, like, I'd like to be a detective in my mind. And reporters and detectives have some things in common, at least good reporters do. And the first thing you need to solve with any issue is what actually happened. Next comes how, and then after that comes who and why, roughly at the same time. Usually when and where is fairly obvious. Dallas, Texas, November 22nd, 1963, around 12:30 p.m. Central Time. When and where is not hard. The rest of it is where it gets difficult, but the thing that has to come first is what. So I'm reading this book, and while as we speak, Barry, I don't want to jump to the punchline too quickly, I'm reading this book and realizing that the whole thing with Oswald, the huge red flag that came when the Warren Commission was introduced and Alan Dulles, the head of the CIA who Kennedy fired, emerges on the very commission investigating this assassination that we're told about. The first thing out of the starting gate is that the American people should have rejected the Warren Commission on its face. That should have been a no-go from the very beginning. As soon as Alan Dulles showed up, the whole thing should have been dismissed. It wasn't just rigged. It was much more than that. I believe, and this is somewhat more speculative, although it's still linked to my research with Brian David Anderson, I believe that the whole Oswald thing, the Warren Commission, Ruby, kind of the whole landscape was basically just a manufactured piece of folklore. And I think some of that is borne out by the fact that the CIA knew so much about Oswald well before November 22nd, 1963. They had, the powers that be had him in their sights for something like 4 years prior to 63. And I think he was simply groomed to be a distraction. You could say a patsy. Maybe patsy isn't exactly the right word, but they had to have someone to pin this on. Whether he was witting or not is another question. But in order to make this thing look like what they planned on telling the American people had happened to Kennedy, they had to lay the groundwork. They had to make sure that things lined up so this easy to blame, frustrated loner, fall guy, lone nut Oswald could easily be pinned for this thing. And then the machinery would go the way they wanted it. They'd make sure he never went to trial and all of that. But, you know, the past is prologue. That saying might fit this situation. But when I finally called Brian after I read most of his book that I received at that conference in shrink wrap, about a year later, I was doing my RBN show at Republic Broadcasting, and I happened to be at Willis Cardo's office on the phone, linked up to the station in Austin, and I was doing the radio show, and Brian came on as a guest, Brian Anderson, the author of this book, and he challenged me on the air, and I always use this metaphor, Jerry, the X-Files metaphor. If he was David Duchovny, if he was Mulder, the imaginative, investigative Mulder, then I was to be Scully, the one that kind of kept him in check, made him double check his facts, prevent him from going off on too many flights of fancy. So the Mulder Scully thing was set up. He'd be the dreamer, and I'd be the one that would rain on his parade once in a while to make sure that he wasn't seeing things that weren't there, that sort of thing. And I accepted the challenge, and what ensued starting in 2008 until about 2014, those were the main years, 2008 through 2014, was an experience that I didn't expect. And as I indicated early in the show here today, I was a little reluctant to go there because this is something that involves a whole new look at the events in Dallas on that fateful November day. And at this point, it's a little hard to avoid getting into the kind of the nitty gritty, the aha moment. But one of the key things came up in the latter part of that time frame between 08 and 2014 when Doug Horn, a researcher who used to be on the Assassinations Records Review Board, was speaking in Virginia, not far from the D.C. line. And I happened to be at the AFP office when I got wind of it. And I went over there as fast as a human being can travel on the Metro train. and got to this hotel, and Doug Horn talked about something I had already seen on the internet, and that's why I knew that I had to go hear him speak. I already knew what he had done. He interviewed a now late but then still alive CIA photo analyst. At his time, in his day, he was the best photo analyst, bar none, in the world. Dino Bruglioni, an Italian fellow that lived in the Virginia area. And he worked for the Naval CIA office there in D.C. The exact name of the office is escaping me at the moment. We'll get that later. But the Zapruder film was taken there and processed. And Dino Bruglioni was known for drawing up those photo boards, those poster boards that they used in the old days before digital photography. And he put together still frames from the unaltered, at that time when he saw it, unaltered Z film, the Zapruder film, the film shot by Abraham Zapruder, a dressmaker, clothing designer that everyone knows about, but a very doctored film, as it turns out. And this is one of the key things. So when Bruglioni made his storyboards or photo boards, there was a definite effort that he experienced to replace his photo boards with another set and not let his see the light of day. Now, you got to keep in mind that this is the weekend after the Friday shooting at Kennedy. And so Dino had no reason to think the film was, you know, like taboo or something. You know, there was no predisposition toward, oh my gosh, I can't look at this. He's a CIA analyst. He's looked at a lot of things, very shocking things. And to him, it was another thing to look at. So he didn't have any particular biases or predispositions one way or the other. And he saw a lot of very strange things that the American people never saw when they were shown the Zapruder film starting in 1975 on the Geraldo Rivero show. But back to square one, his photo boards were replaced by another set without his authorization. Apparently, and Doug Horn could explain this better than I, but apparently because the powers that be did not want Dino's photo boards to be made public. But Dino, again, hadn't thought anything of it. He had no reason to say, well, I can't show this or show that. He just was an honest guy and just wanted to do his job like he would any other thing, right? So the outcome of this was that it was discovered, and Doug Horn has given several presentations on this. It was discovered that the Z film was altered at a CIA lab in Rochester, New York, called Hawkeye Works, run by Eastman Kodak. And Doug Horn has shown the equipment that they used to animate, you heard me, animate parts of that film. That film is part animation, and there are frames missing. The effect of that is absolutely profound. So when you look at the allegation that Kennedy reached for his throat around the time of the first shot, those arms were not really like that. That was an animation. He did not reach for his throat like that. Now, what does that mean? That means that that for sure certifies that they were contriving the idea that a bullet went through the back of Kennedy, through him, and into Connally. That means that did not happen, categorically did not happen. Now, what does that mean? Well, if they wanted to make you think that happened, that means that was really important, a deception that they didn't want revealed. But even Connally went on record very calmly and very logically, straightforward, saying emphatically he knows he was hit by a separate bullet than Kennedy was. That's a very huge lie. They would only animate the film and kind of draw those arms doing that on Kennedy's neck if they wanted to absolutely drive home the idea that the shot was from behind. And even though Connally said what he said and said, I was hit by a separate bullet, the Warren Commission, showing its extreme dishonesty, to a pretty big extent, simply disregarded Connally's own testimony. And to this day, has everyone believing that a bullet went through Kennedy's kind of mid upper back and then out his neck so precisely that it went through his tie knot, where his tie was knotted, which is a total and utter impossibility. But it's very interesting that they went so far as to do an animation on that to drive home that the shot came from behind so they could pin it on their folklore character, the so-called loser LHO, Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, another twist in this, Jerry, is the Mauser. The first gun that was found in the sixth floor building, at the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository, was not the Carcano. It was a German Mauser. It was reported by Walter Cronkite and other big-time reporters. A Mauser was found. Evidently, what happened was that whoever that person was up there that took a poke at Kennedy, and I'm going to say something here, not a fatal poke. There was no fatal shot that came from there. Whoever that was told or assigned, it had to be, there was no way it could be any other way. They were assigned to put three empty casings that would go with the Carcano, the gun attributed to Oswald through a sales receipt, and then leave the Carcano there too. But they had a reason not to use the Italian rifle attributed to Oswald, probably because the scope wasn't set, the sights wasn't set right, and it wasn't all that good of a gun. But a Mauser is a precision German-made rifle. So what apparently happened is the shooter, maybe in a nervous situation, dutifully put the three empty shells there, but rather than leaving the Carcano that goes with the shells, put the Mauser there by mistake, maybe in haste. Then when Roger Craig, the award-winning Dallas County Sheriff's deputy, went up there with Seymour Weitzman and Bill Fritz, two other police officers, they all certified that they had found the German Mauser there. And the one that went on record formally was Roger Craig, that deputy sheriff that was deputy of the year in 1960 for Dallas County. Anyway, there's been two things there that the establishment has tried to drill down, even though the evidence is dead set against them, that Kennedy was shot through the back or back of the neck and that went into Conley. Absolutely not true. And that a Carcano was the only rifle ever found. Totally not true. It was a Mauser. And then they switched it back because there was no connection between Oswald and the Mauser, only that weird sales receipt, I think with the name Heidel we've all heard about, that was attributed to Oswald. And that's just intelligent handiwork. That's CIA handiwork. They're going to draw up, they're going to take their little folklore guy and they're going to give him a receipt and say he owned the gun. And so right there, as I get into much meatier and much more perplexing and surprising and paradoxical issues, those are two mainstays, Jerry, two areas where you can take it to the bank that the powers that be lied through their teeth.
Wow. You know, I knew that there was a massive amount of deception behind this.
Yeah, more so than you can imagine, which I'll be getting to in due time here.
You know, I never was, and until I took over for Tex behind the mic, I never really dug into the JFK assassination. You know, I've talked with Pat Shannon, talked with Michael Collins Piper, I've talked with you. And I am intrigued. Now, I knew after I read Michael's book how jaded, how slanted the Warren Commission was and how intense the amount of deception was put in place between Dulles and James Jesus Angleton and all of the criminals that were running CIA at the time. But before we get into the nuts and the bolts, can you tell me why this cover-up has been so complete and so successful that it's common lexicon in America, in American history, that a magic bullet shot Kennedy, hit John Connally, and Kennedy was shot from that Six-Floor Window by Lee Harvey Oswald. Why has this cover-up been so complete?
It's a psychological operation. What happened in Dallas that day, and I've got to kind of move forward here to reveal in a peel the onion kind of way what really went down. This was not what we were told it was. The reason it's not solved, think of door number two, door number one and door number two, but there's a door number three that you don't see. We basically just been whipsawed between door number one, Oswald did it, sixth floor, conventional story, done deal. And the other is the grassy knoll and basically everything else. Now, what really went down that day was not a stock assassination in any way, shape, or form. And I'll explain what I mean by that. I'm being a little tentative there, but this was a cloak and dagger operation. This was a balls to the wall, absolutely audacious piece of CIA operation here. The line of authority went from roughly George de Morenchild through Ruth Payne. Ruth Payne was much more involved than we're told. The lady who spoke Russian with whom Lee Harvey Oswald and Marina and the two children live in Irving, Texas, and Brian David Anderson, who unfortunately about 3 years ago passed away, the one I did the research with on the book, which became a documentary. My God, I'm hit. I'll explain how people can watch that a little later in today's show. But Brian grew up in Irving, just down the street from Ruth Payne, and he also knew Dr. Charles Baxter. And over the years, he would talk to Dr. Baxter about anomalies in the operating room and what went on. But what's particularly interesting is Brian started out as a photographer before he became an alternative health guy. And he worked at the now defunct Dallas Times Herald. And guess who his boss was who trained him in photography? Bob Jackson, the guy that took the most famous photo of Ruby plugging Oswald, was Brian's teacher.
Wow.
So Brian always felt like he was sort of providentially put, you know, growing up in Dallas, in Irving, where Ruth Payne lived, he just felt like this was put on his lap right before he kind of put it on my lap, because he felt I could be an objective reporter. And he told me later that he approached me on helping him because he felt like I wouldn't just outright reject what might sound to some like a very outlandish theory. But anyway, so I stayed in touch a little bit, at least watching his online presentations. I stayed in touch with Doug Horn both before and after that Virginia program he gave in 2014 that I mentioned a little while ago when I left the AFP office, hopped on the train and went and heard him speak. I kept tabs on him, you might say. I interviewed him that day in an audio interview about the frames taken out of the Zapruder film, the animation done at the Hawkeye Works lab that I mentioned on the Zapruder film. And then when Brian and I went to Dallas in 2013 for the 50th year, we met Mary Moorman, one of the chief witnesses to the shooting on Elm Street, although you know, exactly what happened was kind of put past everyone. They didn't know what they were seeing. But we met with Mary Moorman. We met her there in Dallas, and we got her name, and we met her in Denton, Texas. I believe that's north of Dallas.
Yep.
And we met her up there that same year, 2013. I think she's still alive, so she's really getting up in years. And I can't prove this because I don't have the film clip that Brian made when we interviewed her. But when we told her what we thought happened to Kennedy, and with God as my witness, she agreed that that was the most plausible explanation she had ever heard. And again, I can't prove that. You'll have to trust me on that one, but with the Lord as my witness, and she seemed sincere. I don't think she was just appeasing us. I don't think she was that kind of lady. She was pretty astonished, and you will be too in a minute, Jerry. But Brian had this something that, you know, you meet someone once in a while. They're not just kind of smart. They're not just sort of interesting. They have that something. You can't quite put your finger on it, but Brian had that. He had that, not only the zeal to find out what happened, but this uncanny ability to do it. So not just the desire, but the ability. And I was trying to provide checks and balances. Another plank on this, besides the total impossibility and the animated arms for the magic bullet that I mentioned a few minutes ago, and the Mauser Carcano rifle switch, another plank on this was the ambulance driver, Aubrey Reich, R-I-K-E, Aubrey Reich, Aubrey with a B. He was a extremely efficient, fast, get-the-job-done ambulance driver. And there's one thing that's totally true in the beginning of Oliver Stone's otherwise pretty off-the-mark JFK movie, and that is the epileptic fit that a guy had in Dealey Plaza only minutes before Kennedy's motorcade got to that part of his trip. And that took Aubrey and his assistant ambulance guy, who they nicknamed Peanuts, that took them out of Dealey Plaza just in time, because had this happened when Aubrey and Peanuts were there with that ambulance, they would not have allowed the driver of the 100X Kennedy limo, they would not have allowed that thing to drive away. They would have intervened. And that would have blown the whole gaff, the whole operation. And what happened was that Aubrey was the real guy that picked up the real epileptic fit guy that Oliver Stone fictionalized in the movie, that he showed that happening. This really happened. And I met Aubrey in a Plano, Texas TGI Fridays in around 2009. And he told me this directly himself, that they picked up the epileptic fit guy, took him to Parkland Hospital, where Kennedy's motorcade would arrive just a little while later. And they put him in like a waiting, they put him on like a gurney or something where he was waiting to be treated on. And Mr. Reich went to a cigarette machine. Those were very common in those days. And he got a pack of cigarettes and he was getting a smoke, and he came back in. And to the best of my recollection of how he explained it, and this is more or less what they showed in the Oliver Stone movie, the epileptic fit guy completely disappeared. So Oliver Stone was trying to show, and Mr. Reich actually experienced, that this was a decoy. And the only thing Brian and I could think of, and it's absolutely logical, is they did not want that ambulance in Dealey Plaza.
Wow.
These guys were the best. Aubrey would drive 120 miles an hour in a heartbeat. He was a get-her-done kind of guy. He later became a local police officer. I believe prior to the ambulance days, he was in the military, I believe. But he worked for the O'Neill Funeral Home. That's the funeral home where they called and got the most expensive casket you could buy in those days. I believe it was an Elgin, and ordered it to come over, to bring it over to Parkland Hospital to put this deceased body in. And Mr. Reich told me personally that he wrapped, the body was wrapped in sheets so you couldn't see what it looked like. And it had no wounds in the back whatsoever. There was no back wound. Okay, now this is where we get a little more into the balls to the wall, cloak and dagger operation here.
Mark, we have reached our halftime break. I think that's perfect, because now the suspense is going to drag on. But Mark and I have to take a brief pause. We are discussing JFK at 62. Ooh, I cannot wait to hear what Mark drops on us in the second half. You're listening to Power of Prophecy. Stay with us, won't you? We'll be right back. Final Judgment is considered to be one of the definitive books on the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Through meticulous research, Michael Collins Piper pieced together multiple disparate theories on who was behind the murder. Final Judgment is a two-book set for $40. please add $6 shipping and handling. That will make your total $46. You can order your copy by phoning us toll-free in the United States and Canada at 1-800-234-9673. We accept Visa, MasterCard, Discover, and American Express. You can use those charge cards at our secure shopping cart at powerofprophecy.com. And if you want to send in a check, money order, or cash, please make your check or money order payable to Power of Prophecy, and you can mail it to us here at 4819 R.O. Drive, Suite 102, Spicewood, Texas, and our zip code is 78669. Okay, and now let's return to our regular program. My guest today is Cliff Hanger, a contributing reporter to... I'm just kidding. My guest today is Mark Anderson. Mark, welcome back.
You can call me Cliff if you want, Jerry. great to be back. Good to take a few deep breaths before the second half. And I left everyone with a cliffhanger. Aubrey Reich, the crack shot ambulance driver, who was buffaloed by that scheme and scam where somebody planted a fake epileptic fit guy to get him out of Dealey Plaza, as I mentioned in the first half. He put the body that died in trauma room one, wrapped in sheets, into this expensive casket that came from the funeral home, the O'Neill funeral home for which he worked. And there was no wounds in the back. So that double proves there was no magic bullet going through anywhere on the back through Kennedy into Connolly, along with the animation of the Kennedy roots and career's throat that I mentioned through the Hawkeye Works lab in the first half of today's show. So completely debunked the whole magic bullet thing, which made no sense to begin with anyway, logically. So that is absolutely declared untrue without any equivocation whatsoever. But the wound in the back of the head that bled a lot and they wrapped the body in sheets a lot was in corroboration with another guy that Brian and I interviewed, Dr. Robert McClellan, who has since passed away. He was the trauma room one doctor that, okay, if you imagine the body of the president, quote unquote, laying up, facing up on the hospital gurney thing to be operated on, then McClellan was at Kennedy's head, the body's head that was facing up, and he had his hand underneath the back of the head, and the other doctors surrounded the body. That's why McClellan was, who was among the younger doctors at the time, that's why he was able to ascertain that there was blood coming out from an exit wound, E-X-I-T, exit wound, in the back of the head. And that's how he famously got the blood on his lab coat that he kept until his dying day, and I imagine his family still has it, and he kept the blood on the coat. This is absolutely critical to the whole story. Brian had contacted him more than once, probably three times, maybe four times, practically begging McClellan to test the DNA of the blood that he got on his coat. I think here, Jerry, is where we have to have the drum roll. The reason that Brian wanted to test the blood that got on McClellan's jacket was because Brian, here we go, said that it won't match that of Kennedy. What Brian's ultimate thesis that I became very intrigued with, and I believe apart from some minor anomalies and some unanswerable questions, you have to keep in mind that some questions and some aspects of this crime are not just unanswered, they're unanswerable. There's a big difference there. Too much time has went by, but I'll repeat that. And we took this, I am not making this up, Brian and I in 2010 took this to the, at the time, the new Dallas DA, Craig Watkins, who was solving cold cases, that he made a name for that in the Dallas Morning News. And we went in there and met with one of his detectives, a guy named Rick, who had the most interesting day of his life that day. And we went in there and said, we got a cold case for you to solve that happened in Dallas County. Craig Watkins wants to solve cold cases in Dallas County, unsolved cases. Let's do the JFK one. And this detective was laughing at Brian and I. We just said to him, just go in the envelope, look through the materials, and all you got to do is subpoena or somehow get Dr. McClellan to get that blood tested on his lab jacket. and we contend, and we had a lot of trouble spitting these words out, that it won't match Kennedy's DNA.
Wow.
Yeah. What this means is that there was a body switch. So the body that died in trauma room one was not that of Kennedy. So there was no assassination by rifle fire, and Kennedy was clandestinely removed from the presidency. You could still call it a coup d'etat, but Brian and I believe beyond a reasonable doubt, although some things are simply unprovable, we believe he did not die that day by assassination by rifle fire.
Wow.
That's the reason it hasn't been solved, because it wasn't an assassination at all. You see, as long as they keep you believing he was shot dead with a rifle, you'll just keep going on saying it was Cuba, it was the Russians, it was the mafia, it was a combination thereof. And that's what's happening with the JFK interest groups. They're spinning off into La La Land, reinventing the wheel 10 times over every year, every time November comes around. This was done in a very, as I stated, a very balls to the wall, audacious cloak and dagger operation. The only way they could have done this, and this is what's interesting, not only are we just pointing out how we think they did it, there was really only one way they could have done it, and that the secret is the trunk of the car, that very big trunk of that very big limo. What happened was, evidently, there was a couple operatives in a secret compartment in the trunk, and one shot the other through the head, right at the right spot, through the upper forehead on the upper right forehead of the body, a Kennedy lookalike, and that went out the back of the head, as McClellan saw later in the operating room. And as witnesses heard, that bullet echoed when it hit the street. It went out the bottom of the car, it echoed and hit the street, and a 45 pistol slug, not a rifle slug, a pistol slug was found along the turf along the edge of Elm Street. How did a pistol bullet get along the edge of Elm Street right in that spot in Dealey Plaza? What was it doing there? And then that Kennedy lookalike sat in the trunk by a handler, was rolled out, the seat was popped off, and Kennedy, who was not mortally wounded, was rolled into the compartment and they rolled out the lookalike. That's why the body's wounds, that lookalike's wounds, cannot be aligned with what you see in the Z film, because you were never looking at that person. Kennedy's head was never in the position to receive the wounds that the body had that was taken into trauma room one. Kennedy was leaning to his left and looking slightly downward. So somebody would have had to have been on the floor of the 100X limo shooting upward to go up into his upper right forehead and out the back of his head. A bullet coming from the grassy knoll would not have had that trajectory to hit in that direction. And a bullet coming from the sixth floor school book depository also in no way, shape or form could have went through Kennedy's upper right forehead and out the back of his head. So his head was never in a position to receive the wounds that the body had, the lookalike body that was taken into trauma room one. This was a cloak and dagger body switch operation. That's why the blood coming out of that body onto McClellan's coat probably would not have matched the DNA of Kennedy, because it wasn't him. 1 + 1 = 2.
I'm in shock, Mark. The thing is, it's not hard to fathom them having a body double. I mean, there were two Oswalds. So we know that the logistics involved in something like this, these are planned events.
As I say, some parts of this are a little bit anomalous, murky, unknown, unknowable, unproved, unprovable. But Brian and I always felt like we had at least the minimum requirement, maybe more than the minimum, to establish the beyond the reasonable doubt threshold that would be acceptable if we had honest courts and an honest media, which we don't. And that's a big reason that things are the way they are. But most presidents were rumored to have doubles going all the way back to Ulysses S. Grant, because there were always occasions when the Secret Service and other protectors of the president over the decades, there were always instances when they felt like maybe they needed to use a decoy if there was some sort of terrorist threat, if there was a pending war, if the president was in a hostile foreign nation, whatever the case might be. it's always been just sort of assumed, common American knowledge, if you will, that presidents had body doubles, probably going back as far as Grant. So Brian and I felt also that the body double probably wasn't told that they were going to waste him that day. And I know what this sounds like to anyone who's hearing it for the first time. And that's the reason that I was always a little ambivalent, a little insecure, you name it. When I was working on this, I would lay there almost every night and go, no, this can't be. And then I'd come around again and go, but it explains so many things. And then I'd kind of waffle and vacillate because I too was programmed with the Kennedy folklore like everyone else. Mm-hmm. And I had to go through a sort of intellectual and spiritual withdrawal. I had to completely expunge a belief system that had been implanted in my brain by the news media, academia, many well-meaning researchers. Although I will say, I do think there are a lot of spooks in the JFK research community. At least I think they're in key places, or maybe in recent years they've been there. There's been all sorts of diversions. Now, the old narrative with LHO, Oswald is in trouble. We've got that going for us. But as long as people only assume that this was assassination by rifle fire, and as long as they don't, at least if they would only just entertain the idea that it might not have been that, then they would actually get somewhere. And a lot of people will say also, and I gave some presentations on this, believe it or not, I gave a live one in my hometown of Bridgman, Michigan at the local library. Every librarian they've had there has been totally pro free speech, totally never censored anything I ever said or did, including this presentation. So that's a shout out to my hometown in Southwest Michigan, Bridgman. And when I gave a presentation on this, I put a little blurb in a high circulation newspaper, short notice, Jerry. I got 25 people there, short notice. And of those 25 people, about 17 of them partly or totally believe what I said.
It's completely feasible, Mark, even as my brain is trying to wrap itself around it.
It's interesting in many ways. I'll give you some other bolstering facts, some other things that support it. One of the most powerful ones is, unfortunately, I have to say this, among the many, many lies and fabrications that were expressed by Clinton Hill, the Secret Service agent famous for jumping on the back of the limo, one thing he said that he changed, and this is how I know he was lying, is, well, Brian and I relied on a couple basic principles that the first thing people say upon witnessing an event, their first impressions, we accepted the premise that we would trust first impressions better than subsequent, like, oh, I had to rethink this, or because in case somebody got to them and coerced them into changing their testimony. So we relied on the first impressions principle. And when Clinton Hill jumped on the back of the car, the sequence was Kennedy himself was shot in the shoulder with the Mauser. Glenn Bennett sitting in the same car that Clint Hill jumped off of, the Queen Mary, right behind Kennedy's limo. He said in testimony released around 2012 through the LBJ Library in Austin, there was all the testimony, the initial testimony of Secret Service agents that was kept confidential until around 2012. And when it came out, Glenn Bennett said, I saw the boss get shot 4 inches down from the right shoulder. So Kennedy was shot in the shoulder, not in the head and not through the upper back or neck to come out and hit Connally. And then the second shot, which probably was roughly at the same time that Connally was shot separately, Clint Hill described it as this, and this is a rough paraphrase. I think I mentioned that I heard another shot. It had the sound of a pistol hitting a hard object. It seemed to have some kind of echo, a pistol hitting a hard object. And it wasn't the sewer. The only place he could have heard a pistol without seeing the pistol going off was the trunk. And he was just about to jump on that very trunk, and that's when the body double was shot and that bullet went through the bottom, the pistol hitting a metal object, and the echo being the ricochet of that pistol, 45 pistol bullet that they later found. And here's the key thing that I can't forget because it's so easy to forget. for this, or why did everyone think JFK was fatally shot? They used an incendiary device to simulate a fatal head wound. So Kennedy was shot in the shoulder. Then there was Connally being shot separately. Roughly simultaneously was the shot in the trunk of the body double. And then the incendiary device, this is not something that I'm just talking about for the first time. Evidently, and I know this sounds completely bizarre, evidently Jackie was involved in this, Jerry. Her and Jack did not have the ideal marriage that we're told about.
Yeah.
Not by a long shot. Anyway, the incendiary device was lit off on Kennedy's right shoulder area near the right side of his head. And there were several testimonies, and I can produce them, where people said, I saw what looked like a firecracker. I heard what looked like a firecracker. And when Smiling Ralph Yarborough, Smiling Ralph, they called him, a senator from those days, U.S. senator, when he got to the Parkland Hospital, when the limo arrived, he smelled gunpowder. And he had been an infantryman in World War II. This guy knew guns. The gunpowder was coming from the car. That means whatever was let off originated there. It didn't come from the grassy knoll or the school book depository and hit the car. The gunpowder was indicative that whatever was set off had originated in the limo. So the incendiary device gave the surprised, baffled, totally caught off guard attendee of Kennedy's parade there, anybody standing along the road, if they were close enough, what they saw looked enough like a high velocity bullet impact in the heat of the moment, in the immediacy of the moment. That's what they thought it was. But some people said it looked and or sounded like a firecracker. And that is, in a sophisticated sense, that's what it was. It was a Hollywood pyrotechnic device. Those kind of things have actually been used in movies to simulate firearm impacts, things like that.
Right.
And so that is the critical part of it. So it was shoulder and the simultaneous shots into Connally and the trunk thing, and then the device, that being so-called shot number three, although others said they thought they heard four or five, six shots. But any other shots would have been simple diversions. And then, you know, people will say, well, what about the tramps that were found in the train car, and they were supposed to be tramps, and they were wearing expensive shoes? Brian and I, although he and I debated about a number of things and we didn't always agree on everything, we concluded that the tramps and all of that were just stagehands to add confusion to the situation, that they really had no direct relevance, you know, to create chaos, to create the basis for endless speculation. Oh, what about the tramps? Oh, what about Cuba? Oh, what about the mob? And so on and so forth. But it appears that Kennedy would have had to accept some sort of, what's the word, when you're banished. They did it to Napoleon.
Exile?
Yeah, that he was exiled, given some sort of deal he couldn't refuse, and probably told that you'll go down as a martyred president, a handsome prince, only 46 years old, the first Catholic president, all these first, you know, the firsts of their time, and you'll go down as this martyred, slain prince, handsome, rich, you know, urbane, witty, all this, and you'll be missed. And this deal with the devil, Brian and I logically reasoned, is kind of the only way to explain how he would have agreed to this, although one could speculate that maybe he didn't plan on getting shot in the shoulder. That might have been something that was done to send home the message. And that's what we kind of rested on, is that they shot him in the shoulder to tell him the next one will be real if you blab anything about this. So he would have had to have been taken in the trunk in that same car. That car was put on those large transport planes. What are they called? KC-135?
Right.
Yeah, that's how the limo got there, and that's how the limo left Dallas, in one of those. It stands to reason, and there doesn't seem to be any other way it could have been done, that he was probably drugged and put asleep and taken out in the very trunk that he was rolled into, while the imposter was taken to Bethesda. And now, admittedly, Bethesda is where things get a little bit murky, and we didn't do as much research there as anything prior to the autopsy in Bethesda. But the body that they show with the eyes open, that they've always told us was the slain body of Kennedy, another researcher pointed out that that body looked way too slim. Kennedy had been taking drugs for his back problems and his Addison's disease, and it made Kennedy more puffy and not fat, but he was starting to get a little chunkier in his build. He didn't have that angular slimness that he had when he was a senator and a House member. So the body looked too spelt, you might say, that famous picture with the eyes open and the body's looking up. The researcher I'm referring to said that body possibly wasn't even dead. But be that as it may, that's a little too speculative. That's the other key parts of this research. And there's another thing that happened. There's a very interesting photo that somebody took when the 100X Kennedy limo was en route from Dealey Plaza to Parkland Hospital. A foot slipped off the side of the car. It's a left foot. And Clint Hill was standing very uncharacteristically deep in the back of the car. He was no longer riding on the trunk, hanging on for dear life. He had stood where the back seat would have been, and his feet were too far down for him to be standing on the surface of the back seat where Jackie and Jack would have sat. His feet were sunk down. His legs were sunk down further, very strongly suggesting that he was standing where the seat had been before it was flipped up. And we did learn that that seat did come off the mount. It was made to come off that mount. Then a left foot was shown protruding out the side of the car by the seat where Kennedy had been sitting. Now, if Kennedy had really been mortally wounded in the head, he would have flopped over to his left into Jackie's lap, and there is no way, in my estimation, that he could have stretched his left leg, that he could have done it, or that he could have been made to do it, because we were told he was practically dead already. Clint Hill gave the thumbs down to the car behind him, saying, and Clint Hill testified to this later, saying, it looks terrible. It looks like he's going to die if he's not dead already. So how did a left leg protrude off the edge of the car en route to Parkland? Whose leg was that?
Right.
Logically, it couldn't have been Jack's, because the body would have been incapable of any motor movement, especially stretching out, laying on his left side and putting the left leg, not the right leg, that it would have been higher, but the left leg that would have been lower, and putting that up, bending that left leg up to come over the edge of the car and be seen by a onlooker photographer. And this is a well-known photo. It wasn't Clint Hill's left foot. He was standing, you might say, knee-deep in the back of the car. And it couldn't have been Kennedy's, logically speaking, because if what we're told was happened was true, he would have been too incapacitated to position himself like that. So if you get Columbo on the scene, you're going to say, this bothers me. What's going on here?
Right.
And the only logical explanation is that that left foot belonged to neither Kennedy nor Hill. And it was a male foot. It wasn't Jackie's. So if you look at it through the Columbo lens, and here's what people have said to me, and it's impossible in the time we have to get into Bethesda and all that, but again, our research didn't go real far into that, although I could offer some interesting insights. But they always say you're cherry picking. Now, there's some truth to that, but what I would contend as we wrap up today's show is that there's two kinds of cherry picking. There's the wrong kind, where you completely ignore contradictory evidence that's right in front of you and you don't give it a sufficient look, a sufficient consideration. But there's another kind, I would contend. And the other kind of cherry picking is that when you investigate something like this, you've got to go somewhere with it. You've got to get a trail of breadcrumbs like a bloodhound, and you've got to keep following the trail. Just because you see something along the way that suggests you might be going the wrong way, sometimes you have to keep going anyway. And you see this a lot on Sherlock Holmes. You see it on Columbo. They'll come in and say, But Lieutenant Colombo, it had to have been the wife. She benefited from the insurance policy. And he'd say, you know, you're right, Captain, but something's just bothering me about this. And what Colombo would do is he'd find that hunch, that gut thing, that gut instinct. He'd find sufficient corroborating evidence, and he would keep pulling and pulling and pulling on that thread and pulling some more until that tapestry unravels no matter what. That's what Colombo did. That's what we did. And you have to do that or you don't go anywhere, Jerry. You'll right. spin in circles like these other groups continue to do. And you might be a little sloppy. You might look behind you and go, well, maybe we should have looked at this or that a little more. And then you get a little bit of that vacillating going on, which is only human because you're treading into totally alien territory here, new ground and all that. And yet you come around and you wake up and maybe you look at your own notes again, or you watch Brian's documentary based on this that I'll tell you about in a minute. But you come around and you go, wait a minute. I really think that by and large, we solved this thing. Mm. And you look at it, but most people don't want to hear it if you give them a short version. But again, when I gave the presentation at that library in my original hometown, I got about 2/3 totally believed it, or at least they were reasonably accepting of it because it made more sense than something else. And then you had about another 7 or 8 people that did not buy it at all. And they got, I won't say hostile, but they got a little bit argumentative. I just said, I'm actually not here, I told them, to convince you of anything. I'm here to tell you about what I experienced with Brian David Anderson, what I went through, what I saw, who I talked to. You make up your own mind, but this is why we believe, this is our thesis as to why this thing hasn't been solved. Whether you believe me or not, is I told him, is I would like you to, but I'm not here to convince you.
I want you to give the information on how people can watch this documentary by Brian.
The only place I know where you can get it is on the IMDb online movie rating and movie featuring service. I want to talk about something in particular. There was something that I theorized that turned out to be wrong that I told Brian to take out of the documentary, and he didn't. And that's a short part where it claims that the limo, the Kennedy limo that's now at the Henry Ford Museum in Dearborn, Michigan, near Detroit, is 40 inches shorter than the one that was on the streets of Dallas. That turned out to be totally wrong. That is a major, I won't call it major error, but it's an error of some substance. And it got in the film. It was supposed to be taken out, and it wasn't. Other than that, I think it's largely pretty solid, intriguing to say the least, showing the level of deception. And there's an old saying, and I'll end with this. If the mind is blind, the eyes can't see.
Very profound. All right. Well, Mark, thanks for coming on and being a guest of Power Prophecy. I am intrigued, and it's a little much for my brain to comprehend, but I am going to be deep diving into this. I appreciate you coming on and being a guest, buddy.
Yeah, no problem. This was very much the what and how. And we didn't go so much into the who. I think Mr. Piper did a pretty good job on the who.
Yep.
And we'll leave it at that, Jerry. Thanks for having me on, and thanks for hearing me out. It's not an easy thing to get into.
Mark, you have a great day, and thank you so much, brother. God bless you.
You too.
Okay, that's going to take care of this week's program. My guest today has been Mark Anderson. We want to thank you for tuning in and giving us an hour of your time. We greatly appreciate it. And as always, I pray you will tune in again next week at this same time. Tune in and discover the power of prophecy.